I have, to paraphrase Thoreau, traveled far in Danbury. I have adventured on all the continents, cowboyed in the West, gone to Middle Earth, climbed Mount Everest, planted a flag at the pole. I've plunged beneath the seas, been a pirate on its surface, battled submarines and survived violent storms and doldrums. I've flown through the skies like a bird, like a bullet, and yes, stood with the captains as the Enterprise probed the last frontier. Although I had been to many futures before that and since that time, I have gone into the past and talked with the Buddha. I have seen the human race both thrive and suffer defeat in many universes. I have lived through the death of our planet and the final ends of our universe. And I say ends intentionally, which includes the Book of Revelations. I've traveled far on the wings of the imagination of others and a bit on my own. I have stood with God, as we all just did, as he created the ancestor of us all from the dust of this, his earth. All of that, of course, came from the Bible. And the Bible, as a source of spiritual enlightenment, is a great book and rightfully deserves our study. But the science in it is fiction. And my friend Al once remarked that the Bible is the greatest book of science fiction ever written. I can say that safely here because I think I am preaching to the choir. There's probably no one here in the sound of my voice, for example, who believes the biblical story of creation. And yet it is taught, if indirectly, through belief in the Bible, in millions of Christian churches every Sunday, to millions of impressionable youth and convinced older people. And the Bible is so thoroughly embedded in our culture. The language of Judeo-Christianity is our everyday language. References to its teachings are constant and everywhere. In our political speech, in our swear words, in our comedy, and in our everyday life. We cannot and indeed need not escape from its use as a spiritual guide in our everyday life. It is a good thing. But most of us have and will struggle to shake off the mythology that is embedded in this culture and the religions that we were raised in. At least I think I speak for most of us here. If not, please bear with me just a little longer. Now, I'm not talking about God in any form or the sense of the divine or any version of a power greater than ourselves or our moral heritage. These are very impersonal and important concerns for all of us. I'm talking today about the need every religion has to explain how we got here, and for what purpose. The last 500 years, which saw the arrival of actual scientific investigations, which were largely sparked by the invention of the telescope and the microscope, which opened up the actual study of the very, very large and the very, very small, has been a time of gaining knowledge of what has actually happened. For the first time, we could see a single cell. We now have a pretty complete understanding of the actual creation and other physical and biological developments. And I think it's time that we, as a liberal religion, come out of the closet of smiling pretense and proclaim as one of our principles, an eighth principle, that we know what happened and acknowledge the discoveries of science as the rock, as the foundation on which our other beliefs rest. I know you have all done this in your own minds, but I think it's time that we do it with a formal proclamation. I believe such a declaration would have many benefits. It would clear the air. We wouldn't have to beat around the bush anymore. It would sublimely eliminate the conflict between religion and science. Science would be formally accepted as a part of our religion. And it would act as a beacon to those like us, still culturally bound but in disbelief of the details, who are looking for a religion that makes total sense. Those people could come and join us. A couple of Sundays ago, our minister gave an elegant summary of the creation of the universe and us, beginning with the Big Bang and coming forward 9 billion years to the formation of the sun and the earth, and then doing the next 5 billion years of life on earth, an even more passionate description of the appearance of the single cell life in the warm seas of earth, and the subsequent rough and tumble epic of evolution, where life had to and was able to change and adapt to the changing physical world, and became more complex until we humans blossomed as a unique and exotic flower on one of the many branches of the trees of life. As Michael remarked later in private discussion, and since he's not here to defend himself, he said he had rewritten Genesis. Some of you who were here recognize that fact. I don't think we need to actually rewrite Genesis or, as Jefferson did, produce our own version of the New Testament. In fact, that would only get us into a lot of discussion, which we are famous for. But an eighth principle would help establish us as a rational, if still an emotional, religion. And a few Tuesdays ago in the evening, Michael Dowd gave us a well-developed PowerPoint presentation of these results, an outgrowth of his and his wife's book, Thank God for Evolution. I realize that he chose that title to reach out to the Christian culture. Despite the detail of his presentation, a presentation which he has now done thousands of times, and has been endorsed by at least 3 Nobel laureates, I got the impression that he was frustrated with the lack of impact these well-understood discoveries was making in the Christian world. Christianity was still ignoring this knowledge. But I can understand that even here, we may be a little leery of accepting the scientific discoveries about our origin. I began with the story to the children this morning. If any of you felt that that story was not right, that I shouldn't have told that story, then we need to discuss it. And I admit that when you fully absorb the consequences of these discoveries, it can shake you up a bit. Most of us were brought up on how evolution explains why giraffes have long necks and how we descended from the apes and how it's the survival of the fittest and nature is bloody in tooth and claw. Well, some of this is misunderstanding, and all of it, although important, is, biologically speaking, merely surface results of a deeper truth. For example, we are not really alive. The cells that make up our bodies have life, not us. In fact, cells are the only things that are alive from a biological point of view, from an evolutionary point of view. The cells in our body, to stay alive, have to be constantly nourished. They need oxygen, water, and energy-carrying molecules, food. We have lungs to capture the oxygen, a stomach to capture the food and water, blood to carry the nourishments, and a heart to pump the blood around. If we stop breathing, or our heart stops pumping, then our cells quickly die, and the functions they performed cease, and we die. What part of it all was we? You see, discoveries about how nature works can have an impact on what we consider as our spirituality. Is he breathing, or is there a pulse, or the traditional signs of life or death? They were established long before we had any idea that cells existed. And we see, that, of course, that they led us to believe that we were alive. We also see now that it is the functions that the cells make possible, lungs that take in oxygen, hearts that pump blood, brains that provide control, thinking, remembering, speech, and consciousness, by specializing and working together, make possible what we call living things. And therefore leaves open all of our concern about our spirit and who we are. And as to purpose, nature doesn't seem to reveal any. That doesn't mean we can't have any number of purposes while our cells churn happily away, unable to be concerned about anything except surviving and reproducing. There's also the state known as a deep coma or a vegetative state. The cells of the body are still happily alive, even the basic brain cells. But if there's no sign of mental activity associated with cognitive function, then we declare the person dead. So we, as everyone knows, are located in our brain. And death really refers to the brain not functioning. There's a famous strain of cells, tumor cells, taken from a woman long dead whose generations continue to thrive in petri cells, dishes, to the extent that the number of such cells would fill the Empire State Building. Even though living cells from her body still exist, we don't consider her to be alive. Certainly a human egg cell is alive, and when fertilized in the womb of a woman, divides and divides and divides, and in a short period of 9 months, the cells construct a functioning human being. Truly a miracle of natural forces. And all the cells from the beginning are alive. But at what point did the human being come into existence? One possibility is when brain activity indicates mental activity associated with being conscious. That's the inverse of death. So I grant you that what seems an easy and obvious thing for us to do, to declare that we accept the discoveries of science, may, when we think deeply about the discoveries, lead us to pause and wonder, is this what we really want to get into? So it's not as easy as just putting on a new suit of clothes, clothes that we can take up a tuck here and there and to make it fit better. We can't take up any tucks in reality. But is taking up a tuck here and there really what we want? Don't we really want to face and understand reality in all its surprising ways, then continue to rely on the imaginings of an ancient tribal peoples who were clueless? We cannot escape the language and build-in myths of our culture, when it comes to origins. But we can, as much as possible, separate the wheat from the chaff and proclaim that we will go with the wheat. It is true that we are made of the dust of the earth, but do we need to go any further? What we should do is declare that we know what happened next and go on from there. We need an eighth principle.